Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Now, Africa and the Global South should stand and say there are things we can speak to each other about, there are things we can do, and Uganda provides space for doing this without fear or favor. That, for us, is the biggest gain.
Uganda held two major international events. We'll have details.
In Goma, people were only watching it on TV, but in Tshisekedi's party, they were organizing some activities, public activities, with motorcycles, with their members.
The Democratic Republic of Congo installs incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi at a ceremony in the capital, Kinshasa, Saturday.
You know, for a very long time, Ousmane Sonko's lawyers keep saying that, you know, there's nothing that could bar Sonko from participating in the elections. But finally, when the list was published, his name was not there.
And the Senegal Constitutional Council releases a list of candidates who will contest in the coming February 25th presidential election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda hosted both the Non-Aligned Movement Conference and the IGAD Regional Leaders Summit last week in the capital, Kampala. The meetings attracted African leaders and representatives from over 90 nations around the world. The event, international relations experts say, gives the East African nations significant global attention while boosting local tourism. But opposition leaders say the authorities used the opportunity to undermine their fundamental right of freedom of association and speech guaranteed by the Constitution. The government sharply rejects the accusations. For a look at the impact of the conferences and more reaction, I reach Odrek Rabwogo. He is the chairman of Uganda's Presidential Advisory Committee on Exports and Industrial Development and senior presidential advisor on special duties.
Uganda is led by a group of people that cut their teeth on non-alignment, actually active non-alignment. President Museveni and his group were young people in the 60s, and they came of age when the Cold War ended. And Uganda has maintained what I, for lack of a better term, a maverick position to want to be independent, to want to see the world and countries with respect and mutual interest. And I suppose this is very attractive to many, many countries that find this unilateralism in global politics, in global trade, in decision making, a little bit unpalatable, but they can't say it. Uganda speaks out. Uganda lives its values. And that's why I suppose that these meetings are coming to Uganda.
What is Uganda going to do with all this global attention it's receiving, particularly with hosting these two summits back to back?
I just want you to look at four key things that tell you that we don't live in a fair world. Africa is only 4% of global carbon emissions, but it has 17% of the world's population, but it has all sorts of droughts, all sorts of climate change issues that we now face on top of lack of jobs. When we had COVID-19, Africa was trying to get vaccines. The largest producers of vaccines are in the north. It was a struggle to get them until every other person in the world was vaccinated. Look at trade, $421 billion in 2019 from Africa, but in ores, fuels, agriculture. Yet when you demand for technology, for patents, they are not available. You have two minerals, for example, cassium and rubinium, that make global positioning system technology, but we can't make these things. Now, Africa and the Global South should stand and say there are things we can speak to each other about, there are things we can do, and Uganda provides space for doing this without fear or favor. That, for us, is the biggest gain.
What do you say to critics of the administration, including two major opposition leaders who say that their fundamental rights guaranteed by the Constitution was violated because they were prevented from organizing a protest to bring attention to concerns they have about Uganda, and that you know, their supporters were threatened with arrest, and police and military surrounded their houses, literally putting them under house arrest. Your response to that?
So Uganda has the truest, in a truest sense, the best form of media freedom. You have 365 days within which to make a case in the media, global, and they do it. The lack of a sense of hospitality, that when visitors come to your home, you do not raise your internal grievances, yet you have all the fora. You have the inter-party political system to discuss all these issues. You have parliament with 40, most about 60%, less than 40, and a number of them in the opposition. There are many channels to raise things, and in my opinion, and this is really my opinion, this is just climbing a tall pole when visitors are here, just so that you make a point you've made so loudly and Ugandans have rejected it. They have freedom to do what they need to do. They have 365 days. They don't need to do it when we have 28 heads of states. Yet you really need a sense of cooperation. But if I can really say this, why don't they speak about economic rights? Why don't they speak about trade, the things that create jobs for a million kids who will graduate? What are rights if the opposition doesn't think of the things that develop the country?
Before you go, Audrey, what should be the expectations and benefits for the people of Uganda following this two summits that Uganda hosted recently?
So Uganda, about three of them. The first is the awareness that there's a part of our world, our universe, that has alternative thinking on global issues, some of the things I mentioned, and that those voices have a home, and Uganda is not ashamed of providing that home. The second one is a sense of awareness of the role a rising Africa should play, and as much as the global south, because we are projecting that by 2030, 80% of the middle class will be in the global south, and they require a place where these conversations can happen openly and there is listening. The third one is that in the last couple of days, we spent a lot on our roads, on our infrastructure, and this will be used for tourism. It will be used for conferences. If we use it for trade, for me who is engaged in finding markets, it was an opportunity to retool our capabilities to be able to host all these numbers that are in Kampala today.
Odrek Rabwogo is the chairman of Uganda's Presidential Advisory Committee on Exports and Industrial Development and senior presidential advisor on special duties. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Still in Uganda, Patricia Scotland, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations, is calling for an expedited solution to what she says is the disproportionate impact of economic and environmental challenges on developing members of the organization. She's also calling for more targeted international support for countries that are most affected by climate change. The call came during the just-ended Non-Aligned Movement Summit in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. For more about her call, I reached Patricia Scotland in Kampala, Uganda. Here is the conclusion of the conversation. Do you think there's a need for a more targeted international support in this drive?
I think there is. And, you know, you've seen the Bridgetown Initiative. You've seen the pleas that we made at the World Bank. You were with us when we were knocking on the door at the UN General Assembly, and most recently in COP28. And we are saying we need a new construct. We need GDP plus, and we need it now. And the debt issue is something which we are really pushing hard. So I think we need to understand that this crisis isn't going to go away. And if the last 3 years are anything to go by, it's going to be intensified and more complex. Look at what people are talking about now, that this COVID-19 may not be the last pandemic. We may be looking at another pandemic round the corner. We have to be ready, and we cannot any longer try to deal with 21st century problems using a 19th century framework and construct. It doesn't work. So this new approach, this holistic approach, is really important. But I think there is so much hope.
What would you say has been the progress made at COP28, and how do you think that can be turned to those commitments into action, particularly in terms of fast-tracking, financing, and renewable energy, as we talk about the climate at the ongoing conference in Uganda?
Well, I think the big thing that we got in Sharm el-Sheikh was loss and damage. You'll remember that we were pushing hard in Kigali at the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth heads of government were the first to put in their communique that we had to have a loss and damage fund. And by God's grace, and a lot of hard work, in Sharm el-Sheikh, we got the loss and damage fund. But it was only last year in Dubai that we actually got money committed to that fund. And many of us will say, not enough money, but you know what? I am a glass half full person, not a glass half empty. So we've started. But the most important thing is people need not to just talk about the money, because we were promised money back in 2009, for which we're still waiting. So I think what has to come out of COP28 is that those who pledged must pay. And we have to have a system which is fast enough that people will not be waiting for money to come out of that loss and damage funds 10 years or more, because they made the pledge in 2009. Here we are in 2024, and the pledge of 100 billion still has not been fully honored. So I hope that we will get that on. But we've also got to look at the transition that we need, the energy, the sustainable energy transition that needs to be delivered to move us out of fossil fuels into green energy. And there are so many more things, but young people, the fact that we've got to educate our young people more, we've got to look at carbon tax. You know that we're doing that in the Commonwealth. We came up with a carbon tax framework legislation. So for those countries who are interested in carbon tax, they can look at if they like it, how it works, how it doesn't work. There is so much for us to do, but I think my bottom line is COP has to mean a step change in implementation and action. I hope it'll mean that our Living Lands Charter, which seeks to deliver action on the three Rio Conventions, will be fully funded and fully supported. I'd like to see climate change staying at the top of the agenda, but I'd also like to see our Blue Charter get proper funding for oceans. We've got our Oceans Incubator coming up with some really insightful, dramatic, successful ideas as to how we make use of blue carbon. So all of this, blue and green trade. I want us to deliver by 2026 the $1 trillion worth of intra-Commonwealth trade and $2 trillion by 2030. And we can do it if we go green and we use the new digital platform we have to accelerate it. So I know it's a challenge, but I think if we are determined and if we join together and show and demonstrate solidarity, then it can be done. But I think there's no point in us pointing at somebody else to say they should. I think our message has to be we should. It starts with us.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Substance abuse, including alcohol and illicit drugs, negatively impact those who abuse them, their families and society, often with serious health and financial consequences. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we will discuss women surviving alcoholism and substance abuse. We will also hear from women and medical specialists.
Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, incumbent President Félix Tshisekedi was officially installed at a ceremony in the capital, Kinshasa, Saturday. The inauguration gives the president a second five-year mandate. It followed a disputed election by opponents who reject the outcome of the December 20 presidential poll, saying it was fraught with voter irregularities and lack of transparency. Political observers say expectations for the president to keep his promise to unite the country, bring peace, and protect the lives of citizens are high among his supporters, but not so much in the strongholds of his opponent. For more reaction about the installation and expectations, I reach Espoir Ngalukie. He is the leader of Lucha, or Fight for Change, a non-violent civil society group in Goma.
In Goma, people were only watching it on TV, but in Tshisekedi's party, they were organizing some activities, public activities, with motorcycles, with their members. But in the opposition, we had some demonstrations in Goma. But policemen and military came immediately and arrested some people of the opposition. But they liberated them during the night. And in Goma, we didn't have any specific activity.
The president promised to bring peace. What are the expectations of people in Goma about peace?
I think the only thing that Goma's people need is peace. And now, I don't think that we'll have peace with their method to bring foreign countries like countries of SADC, South Africa, Malawi, and Tanzanian military. They are here in Goma right now to fight against M23. And M23 is the main rebellion group. And now they are controlling two territories of North Kivu. Right now, and in few months ago, we had East African countries in Goma. Their militaries from Kenya, South Sudan, from Uganda and Burundi, they were in Goma. Their mission was to fight against those rebellions, but they failed to bring foreign countries to fight against those rebellions. I think it's a bad solution.
What do you think is the best way forward to resolve this problem of the lack of peace in Goma and its environs?
The first way is the equipment of our army. This is the first thing. The logistics of our army is very down. The second thing is to give justice his job. Justice has to work. You know, right now, we have some ministers, we have some parliamentarians, we have many people in our army, they were rebellions. They killed people. And now, justice didn't do anything right now. And I think if justice can work, it will help us to have the best solution. Because we can't think that we'll have peace without justice. It can't happen. And the third thing is to give job to young people, because many people who are in those rebellions, they are very young, and they are there because of jobless. They don't have job. That's why they are in those rebellions. If Tshisekedi can use them, I think we will not need again to bring some countries to come and to bring security in Congo.
So do you think the opposition parties can help the government to try to bring peace by suggesting ways to end the violence and insecurity?
I think everyone have given those solutions. And the thing that didn't happen is to adapt those solutions. And even the President Tshisekedi, he knows those solutions. But you don't need to put them in, to act with them. This is the problem.
So you expect more action from the president in order to bring peace to the country, especially in Goma?
Yes, and new actions, new solution, not former solutions to bring foreign countries to bring security. It's not a good.
Espoir Ngalukie is the leader of Lucha, or Fight for Change, a nonviolent civil society group in Goma. He spoke with me from Goma, DRC. In Senegal, the Constitutional Council has released a list of those who qualify to contest as candidates in the coming February 25th presidential election. It, however, excluded opposition leader Ousmane Sonko and Karim Wade, the son of former President Abdoulaye Wade. The council's list of approved candidates includes Sall's hand-picked successor, Prime Minister Amadou Ba, former Dakar Mayor Khalifa Sall, and former Prime Minister Idrissa Seck. It said opposition firebrand Sonko's bid was ineligible due to a suspended sentence linked to a defamation case. President Macky Sall will hand over power after ruling out a third term in July. For more reaction, I reach reporter Alpha Jallou in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
You know, for a very long time, Ousmane Sonko's lawyers keep saying that, you know, there's nothing that could bar Sonko from participating in the elections. But finally, when the list was published, his name was not there. Another big surprise was Mr. Karim Wade, the son of former President Abdoulaye Wade, who everybody thought that he would be included in the list. But just a few days before the list, there was some kind of contention between Mr. Karim Wade, you know, dual nationality, and some of the presidential candidates like Cherno Alassane Sall, who is also a presidential runner. They just brought that case before the Constitutional Court. People thought that maybe it wouldn't have been a serious matter. But then during the review exercise, the Constitutional Court found that, you know, Mr. Karim Wade hasn't renounced his French nationality. As a result of that, his name was not included in the list of those vying to be, you know, presidential candidate for the forthcoming presidential election slated on the 25th of February this year.
The supporters of Ousmane Sonko and Karim Wade reacted to their exclusion from this list?
Yes, exactly, especially supporters of Mr. Karim Wade. On many radio stations, they've been reacting, especially, you know, Mr. Karim Wade has a very strong support base in the city of Touba, the religious city. So most of them said that, you know, I mean, the Constitutional Court has just not done it correctly. So because Mr. Karim Wade recently sent his lawyer, and also the French Ministry of Interior sent a letter to the Constitutional Court saying that Mr. Karim Wade have already renounced his French citizenship. So, I mean, there's no reason why he should. Well, there are reactions are pouring from various quarters as we speak now.
The Prime Minister was included, and two women were also included. Overall, what has been the reaction since the list came out?
What people are saying right now, they say that Anta Babacar Ngom, who is the first, this is the first time, you know, she's running as a presidential candidate, and she's also the youngest presidential aspirant in the country, and she has no experience. This is the first time. So people are saying if that lady could you know, just go through the sponsorship, you know, and all these, you know, nomination papers and got everything correct without any problem. Why the reason? Because you can see that the list also excluded, you know, many, many other, like the former prime minister, you know, Aminata Touré. Aminata Touré, you know her very well, Mimi Touré. I mean, because she couldn't, you know, pass the nomination stage and all those things. So they are saying that they cannot understand how the Constitutional Court, you know, the system that the Constitutional Court use in screening, people who want to, go through the, electoral process. So this is the problem. The candidates, they are all complaining whether there is a problem with the logistics of the Constitutional Court in screening out the candidate during the stages of the nomination papers and so forth. So there's a problem. There's so many people are complaining. But the big blow is Mr. Karim Wade, because just, you know, a long process has taken Karim Wade and the Khalifa Sall, because 2019 they were not, you know, allowed to contest. This year, the laws were, you know, reviewed, and so that they will be allowed. And then the process, everybody thought that, Karim, but then in the last stage, when Cherno Alassane Sall presented, the case against Karim Wade, dual nationality, that's the problem. And so people are reacting. For Mr. Sonko, people, saying that, you know, they all expected that, you know, Mr. Sonko will not be included because all the charges leveled against him, his supporters are saying that they are all politically motivated.
Alpha Jallo is a reporter. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Sierra Leone's former president Ernest Bai Koroma, charged for his alleged role in what authorities call an attempted coup, arrived in the Nigerian capital Abuja on Friday. Koroma, who led the country from 2007 to 2018, received permission from judicial authorities on Wednesday to spend a maximum of 3 months in Nigeria for medical treatment. Current President Julius Marabio called the court's decision a humanitarian gesture during an address to the nation on Thursday evening. Koroma landed in Abuja on Friday afternoon, welcomed by National Security Advisor Nuhu Ribadu and the president of the ECOWAS Commission, Omar Aliu Toure, according to an AFP journalist. For more reaction from Sierra Leone, I reach Abdul Fatoma. He is the Executive Director of Campaign for Human Rights and Development.
This morning, Sierra Leoneans saw ECOWAS communique on social media saying that they're grateful to the government of Sierra Leone for giving a humanitarian gesture to the former president for leaving Sierra Leone for medical, you know, relocation in Nigeria. And they see that as a way of saving Sierra Leone and saving the region. So it has sparked a lot of provocation to our country national law. Sierra Leone is a constitutional republic country. The president, when he was making a speech to the nation, he said that his attorney general actually argued against the request from the former president lawyer, but then the court went ahead to grant, you know, former president, you know, the bill request. So it has sparked a lot of things. That what is this humanitarian gesture, and how we have got saved when former President Koroma is no longer in Sierra Leone?
Abdul, so for those who are displeased, what is their main bone of contention about this gesture from the government?
The ruling party supporters, they have been castigating the president, even sending death threats that he have allowed former president actually to escape justice. I mean, this is what they are saying. And they don't believe that, you know, former president is in Nigeria for any medical reasons. I mean, it's just way of perverting justice. That's what they believe. And that's the reason why they have been attacking the president, you know, and his government. And some are even saying, you know, they want to step down their support for him and his political party. So it is a whole lot of outrage, and people think that it's a miscarriage of justice, and it is unfair with all the detainees as well who are in the detention, who have requested for medical leave, but, you know, the court rejected them.
Are they worried or concerned that the former president might not return to Sierra Leone to face justice, because his court date for his trial to face those charges against him is scheduled for March 6th. Is that their concern?
That's the larger concern to some people. And some is a wait-and-see situation, still waiting back for March 6th. And you might record the first letter that ECOWAS issued out demanding from the governor of Sierra Leone through the approval of the president to allow former president to relocate temporarily to Nigeria. That was without any request of health grounds. And then later on, the entire system changed, now on health grounds, and the destination still doesn't change. But what people actually know, former President Koroma, he used to fly to Germany for all his routine medical checkup when he was in power and when he left the office of president. So for him now to choose Nigeria on health grounds, you know, it somehow looked dodgy, you know, in the minds of several Sierra Leoneans. And so when the latest development popped up that former President Koroma will be in Nigeria on health reasons, and the previous ECOWAS report was for him to be relocated to Nigeria on temporary grounds, you know, he will be back. And when that one backfired through public outcry, and you know, the pattern changed. Now, upon his arrival in Nigeria, ECOWAS, you know, put out a statement saying ECOWAS commend the humanitarian gesture that stands to save, you know, the greater interests of Sierra Leone and the ECOWAS region.
Abdul Fatoma is the Executive Director of Campaign for Human Rights and Development. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. Five kidnapped Nigerian sisters have been rescued after their abduction and the death of another sister triggered a public outcry, police said on Sunday. The sisters were seized at the start of the year by armed men who burst into their home just 15 miles from Abuja Center, according to the family. Attackers killed one sister, 21-year-old Nabiha Al-Kadriya, when a ransom deadline passed. Federal Capital Territory Police and the Army rescued the girls on Saturday night in the Kajuru Forest in neighboring Kaduna State. A cousin of the girls confirmed to AFP that they were back with the family. Kidnapping for ransom is a major problem in Nigeria, with criminal gangs targeting highways, apartments, and even snatching pupils from schools. Gangs known locally as bandits operate out of bases in forest across the northwest and central state. After public outcry over the sisters' case, President Bola Tinubu condemned what he called the recent spate of kidnappings and bandit attacks. Tinubu has made tackling insecurity one of his major promises since coming to office in May last year. An apparent Israeli attack on top Iranian military commanders in the Syrian capital Damascus killed five, according to the Iranian government, and caused a building in a residential neighborhood to collapse, burying a number of people under the rubble. Some analysts say the attack is likely to push Iran to retaliate in unpredictable ways. Israel, which has conducted similar attacks in the past, maintains a policy of not commenting on who was responsible for them. For VOA, Edward Iranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
An apparent Israeli attack on an Iranian military target Saturday in the Syrian capital, Damascus, has killed at least five top commanders of Tehran's elite al-Quds forces. The attack leveled a residential building, burying victims under the rubble. Syrian TV showed a crane trying to remove debris from the collapsed building to pull bodies from under the rubble. Israel has not officially commented on whether it was behind the attack. Rami Abdulrahman of the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Arab media that he believes an Israeli rocket struck the building, causing it to collapse. He says that an Israeli missile struck the building, despite some reports that a car bomb caused the explosion, which resulted in the building housing the Iranian commanders to collapse. He says that the area that was hit has an Iranian Revolutionary Guard presence, as well as forces belonging to the Islamic Jihad organization and Lebanon's Hezbollah militia. London-based Iran analyst Mirdad Khansari tells VOA that Israeli attacks on targets in Syria have been increasing in recent months, especially after the October 7 Hamas terror attack on southern Israel, and that many of the Iranian commanders are actively plotting attacks on Israeli targets inside Israeli territory.
The Syrian growing zone in Gaza has obviously accelerated and increased the number of Israeli attacks on such targets, some of which are in response to actions being taken by these elements who are against Israeli locations and where people live on the Israeli side of the Syrian border across the Golan, and of course, and more importantly, from the Lebanese border, given the fact that the supplies for Hezbollah in Lebanon comes through Syria.
Arab media reported that an Israeli drone also targeted a vehicle in southern Lebanon in which two Hezbollah commanders were riding Saturday afternoon, destroying it. The victim's charred remains were reportedly taken to a local hospital for identification. Joshua Landis, who heads the Middle East Studies program at the University of Oklahoma, tells VOA that he thinks both Israel and Iran are trying to draw the U.S. into a larger regional conflict by some of their actions.
Already, Israel, a little over a week ago, killed the top commander in Syria, top Quds commander, along with a bunch of his associates. And this put tremendous pressure on Iran to respond. And now, just at a time when we need a little calm in order to try to talk this down, this Israeli assassination of top Iranian leaders is going to force Iran's hand, and the supreme leader has to retaliate.
Landis notes that Iran has responded in the past week by sending missiles to Syria, stressing that the many Israeli and American attacks on Iranian leaders has built pressure on Iran to act. Nations whose people get killed, he argues, often strike out in very irrational ways. We're going to see this from Iran, he adds, and they're likely to do something stupid. Landis stresses that U.S. forces in both Iraq and Syria have been targeted by pro-Iranian militia fighters in recent days and weeks. He adds that Iran has tried to suck the U.S. into a wider regional conflict by using Yemen's Houthis to target U.S. ships in the Red Sea. Iran's supreme leader has repeatedly urged the Houthis, who receive Iranian missiles and drones, to step up their attacks against U.S. vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Both Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces and Lebanon's Hezbollah militia reportedly have commanders in Yemen to advise the Houthis. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings, heard every weekday at 1500 Universal right here in VOA Africa and worldwide. And coming up on Tuesday, another Spotlight Artist of the Week feature, and next week it will be Skip Ewing on Tuesday. So make sure you tune in at 1500 Universal for Skip Ewing and for all the great music on Border Crossings from Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, there were two major meetings that deserve some attention. The first was the yearly Davos Forum in the Swiss results, and the other is the non-aligned movement, and this time they were meeting in Uganda. The Davos Forum has a tantalizing topic, renewing trust. But for some time now, that forum has been seen as the club of the rich, where the chieftains of industry meet to exchange opinions and contacts. And usually, attending will be leading political figures. But by and large, few nations of the Global South are invited. This year, the focus was on economic growth. Although the three major speeches that were covered extensively, that of the Premier of China, Li Qiang, Paul, the wonderland of the European Union, and of course the ever-present President of Ukraine. When you look at the speeches of both wonderland and President of Ukraine, you do not see much of renewing trust. Both speeches dealt with the call to arms to confront what they call Putin's Russia. Nothing unusual. But when you turn to Premier Li Qiang, you could see that China had three main purposes to convey in the speech. The first is to reassure the business global community that China would continue to open up and to emphasize high-level development. The premier assured the world community that China would maintain high growth because there is concern that any slow growth of China would adversely affect global economy. He said that China hopes to maintain a growth of 5.2 GDP, although Western economists are talking about 4.8. He also touched on an issue which has caused some controversy. That is the question of the reliance on China. The EU and the Western world tried before to talk about decoupling, but Western industrial leaders rejected that on the grounds that they depend heavily on China for trade and for global production, because they believe China has an abundance of top-notch engineers, and they invest in China to make of these innovating engineers. Li Chan also turned his attention to the question of de-risking. He said it doesn't make any sense to talk about de-risking for China. What he said should be the focus is to realize that China provides opportunity for economic growth in the global community. He also touched on the question about AI. He referred to the many proposals to regulate advance on AI, done first in Britain, America and others, and of course the Secretary General of the United Nations has set up a panel with broad geographical to look at that. But Li Chan said there is no cause to be afraid of AI. Like all new technological development, he said, they are good and bad. But he said, with emphasis, that humans control AI. AI does not control people. He gave every indication that China would proceed with the development of AI because he said it holds good prospects for world economy. And he wants the developing countries to benefit rather than to be left to mend for themselves. When we turn to the issue of the non-aligned of 120 countries, mainly from the global south, it is regrettable that it was not covered much by the global press. But it is insignificant, because what the non-aligned have to say is very significant. For example, in Davos, very little was said about the grueling war in Gaza, with this huge unprecedented casualties. But in the non-aligned meeting in Uganda, the main issue was what was going on in Gaza and the pain and travail of the Palestinian people. Therefore, the conference, the summit which began on Friday, is already showing that it's going to focus its final decision on that problem. For example, they are calling for total, immediate humanitarian ceasefire. And they are also calling for two-state solution to bring an end to the problem in the Middle East. And in this regard, it's important that we take note of the controversy about two-state solution. Quite frankly, there have been too much freelance pontification about the facts of the Middle East. And when you look at the facts, not the speculation, you can see that it is troubling that there would be any debate about two-state solution. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Something's got a hold on me lately, though I don't know myself. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Trying my best to keep from tearing the skin off.
bones.
I wanna show you all.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and our engineer Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you only focus on beauty in your search for a wife, you will end up marrying a very beautiful problem. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.